Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. The trippy sounds of Mark Pilkington behind us. We will venture into another and particularly hidden corner of the cultures of consciousness today. In 1991, I went to the Vermont Rainbow Gathering. It was a national rainbow gathering held in Vermont, as I said, in the Green Mountains. And I was a kind of a young buck reporter. And it was the first piece that I did, which I did many later, of just going to a scene, going to an underground experience, a fringe festival, a hidden group somewhere, and just exploring and writing about my experiences. And one of the wonderful things about festivals, you know, Burning Man, Rainbow Gathering, all sorts of traveler events, beach burns, all sorts of things. But you get enough people there, and you get far enough away from business as usual, and there's this magical environment where anything can happen. And often, if you're in the right frame of mind, the things that do happen seem to be relevant to your own life. You meet people that you need to meet. You have experiences that you need to have. You get messages, hear songs, encounter moments that have a kind of synchronistic quality. And one of my experiences at the Vermont Rainbow Gathering was stumbling across this metaphysical library that these mad folks had set up high in the woods. So they had hauled boxes of books, you know, I don't know how far, a couple miles up this steep mountain from the parking lot, and set up this quite a far away from most of the action. So you really had to be stumbling around in the edges of the social space to come across this library. And one of the individuals I met at the library, a couple of the people I met there are still good friends of mine. And one of them was this silent fellow named Jody Edmondson, and he had taken a vow of silence. And so I didn't really get to know him very well because he was, well, after all, silent. The great irony being that once I finally did get to know him in New York, and then later in San Francisco and various other places where we have had many a good time, is that Jody is quite voluble and in fact is a remarkable storyteller. And it's for that reason that I have and asked him to join us here in Expanding Mind, and he has joined us because he has a lot of great stories. But one of the stories that he has that I think is particularly relevant to the things we're interested in this show, and something that's not often really talked about, or at least talked about very well in our city, whether you think about that society on the mainstream level or even in terms of countercultural ideas or radical ideas, is the experience of, well, going crazy, of having a full-on, no-holds-barred, metaphysically charged psychotic break. And for, you know, reasons that lie in the great mystery of experience itself, such an event occurred to Jody. And so I asked him to come on and to talk about it and to talk about some of the issues it raises, metaphysical, personal, and just to kind of give us a flavor for how reality can change and can happen to any of us, and the curious resonances that come out of such an experience. We will not be joined today by our usual co-host, Maj Dau, unfortunately. So we are just going to carry on with Jody. Jody, thanks so much for being on Expanding Mind.
No, thanks for having me, Eric.
Excellent. And you're calling from San Francisco, right?
Yes, I'm actually sitting at the corner of California and Pine right now.
Beautiful, beautiful. So listen, I just, you know, I haven't heard this tale for a long time. I think the first time I heard it in its entirety, or a version of its entirety, was at Burning Man in 2000 or 2001. And, you know, I just kind of hand you the mic, you know, basically. I just love for you to go through, and what happened to you?
Well, you know, it was kind of fascinating. The tale sort of begins at a Grateful Dead show, which is probably not that uncommon with regard to these sorts of tales. I was in Hampton, Virginia, and it was 1987, and there were several things involved. You know, of course, there were psychoactives, there were opiates involved, but I also think that the scene probably had as much to do with it as anything. I was also probably affected by a romantic relationship that I was in, so it was really a confluence of factors more so than anything. And I guess it came on very subtly. I guess that's the nature of one of the things I think that I didn't understand, that I came to understand, just the notion of hallucination or reality, the fabric of reality. When it begins to bend like that, it's not, that sort of theoretical hallucination where you're actually seeing things, you know, that aren't there, and it's very sort of psychedelic and Alice in Wonderland-ish. And in fact, my experience was it feels just like you're in normal reality, you know, but something has shifted dramatically with regard to the way things are interacting. And I guess really it's an acausality is the thing that you notice. There are places that you're very familiar with in your normal day-to-day life that suddenly are very different, but it's very subtle. And so initially what happened, and I owe it to also say that typically there was also, I had at this point had read through the Judeo-Christian Bible, I guess, three times, and I was finishing up a third read through, and so I'm in the middle of Revelations, I'm at a Grateful Dead show, I'm in this romantic relationship that's very heavy, that's causing me to be, you know, very frank and honest, and I've taken LSD at this point, and after the first show and just the whole tribal thing, and I get to these shows and I realize that they're not, you know, hippiedom's not this sort of happy, warm, fuzzy thing, but it's actually this very edgy thing, and so there are these sort of prophecies that start to come into play. I start meeting these characters that sort of give me little fragments of things that are to come, and then they do come to pass. And as each of these things starts to come to pass, it's sort of hair raising. It you know, I'm sort of feeling at this point like there's this profound thing that I'm part of, that there are people who are kind of hip to this, and I'm just sort of suddenly, you know, coming into it. Now I'm starting to see things in this different way, and eventually got to this point where you at least with me, I got to this sort of archetypical battle of good and evil, and how I play out in this battle of good and evil, and I end up fleeing the shows and driving back to the college town. I was going to school in Knoxville at that point, and fleeing back to Knoxville, and on the road, you know, you just the classic sort of psychotic break things start to happen. The radio begins to speak directly to me and tell me where the police are along the road and how fast I can be driving. And so there's periods where I can speed, and there's a policeman up ahead, you need to slow down. And so I slow down, and then just on cue, there's the policeman. And but really at the root of it was this notion of getting back to Knoxville and finding these clues in my apartment that then would lead me on what was this sort of cosmic game where I had to go and sort of right the wrongs of humanity on this cosmic game. And in the process of doing that, I turn around, I have to head back to where I was. I have to get back to this hotel room where everything started. And there's sea creatures that are speaking to me from the ocean, that are beckoning me. You know, whales are involved, dolphins, sort of mammals of the sea. And as I'm traveling back towards the room, several hundred miles away where I just came from, and following these clues, and as I go even into quick marts and things along the way, I have these people, that clearly recognize me. They know that they are hip to this thing that I'm on. They're part of the game. They're part of the know. And at some point, I had this shattering realization. I was just like, okay, so this is something's wrong. This can't be right. And I'm traveling down Interstate 40 in North Carolina, and I just do a U-turn in the median because I feel like, okay, I've lost it. And right as I do.
So that was the point where you started to feel that, like, that something was wrong with the way you, because up to this point you'd been like, oh, well, this is just what's happening. I'm proceeding forward. Life is unfolding. And then at a certain point you were like, whoa, something's wrong.
I mean, up until that point, I'm on this heroic journey. I mean, I'm invincible. I'm in a full on manic state, and it feels great, in terms of just the rush of the whole thing. And then suddenly I have this moment of doubt. And at that point, yes, that was where I thought, oh, this can't be right. Whatever's happening. And so I do the U-turn in the median, and at that point, what the radio was saying, the way reality was going, it was a full shift from manic into absolute dread at that point. You've blown it. One of the things that was central to this thing was that it was very, with the how fast you can drive and there's a policeman up ahead and everything, was very timed. Right, whatever these messages were, I was on this hyper accurate schedule in order to make it to this vector point in Hampton, Virginia, where I was going to, in my mind, break through to some alternate reality that I'd been trying to break through to for some time, or didn't quite know what this thing was, but it was this irritating itch, to get to this group of people, to this community. And in my mind, there was all sorts of subtales going on, tenants that I would have to pay once breaking through that would prove my worthyhood to be there. And, it would be time would bend, so it would be like I'm in this alternate reality for long periods of time, while life here essentially would be going by minutes. It would seem like hours to me that my parents would never even know that I had existed, that my friends would never know I had existed as soon as I sort of broke through the specter. But sort of when the piercing of the illusion happened and I did the U-turn in the median, the radio, essentially gave me messages, now you've blown it, you've blown the schedule, there's no way for you to get back on track, you'll never make it through the vector, now you're stuck here. And at which point, I literally, my car got stuck in the median. I couldn't get from one side to the other.
That's so symbolic.
I mean, I'm stuck, right? I'm in limbo. And so then it became very strange, because then a forest ranger, of all people, drives up. And he seems to be hip to everything, and he's compassionate. And he wants to help me, and he says to me, you have to decide which side you want to go to. Do you want to continue going to doing the U-turn, or do I need to get you back on the side of 40 that you were on, And so he's got me. I'm on I'm balancing on a razor blade at this point, trying to decide what to do. And so I'm like, no, get me on the other side. Get me on the other side. And so he says, okay, I'm going to try and get you on the other side. At which point, I mean, just a storm trooping of state troopers descend on me. I mean, first a couple of cars and then several cars. And the next thing I know, and they tell the forest ranger he's got to go away and that they'll take it from there. And so he has to, he kind of shrugs and, has to leave me. And at which point, it became you know, just the nightmare that everyone sort of, I guess, entertains with regard to the police and hippies and this sort of situation where they, you know, the next thing I know, I'm in the back of the police car, one of the police cars, and they're, they drive me away from my vehicle, you know, and they're questioning me. And initially I'm trying to kind of be straight with them and tell them what's going on. I don't get too far into, to, you know, the game that I'm part of or where I'm trying to get to, but, and then, you know, then they started playing sort of head games with me. And I said, you know, take me back to my car. And they told me, we can't arrest you. You know, you haven't really done anything wrong. We're observing you. And so I, you know, I'm like, I want to go back to my car. And they're like, what car? And I'm like, you know, the car you took me from. And then that's when everything came completely unhinged, because now they're claiming I don't have a car. They're claiming they picked me up on the side of the road, you know, and it, very confusing. And so eventually they take me back to the state trooper station. And I mean, it's, you know, we're deep in the South. We're in, Broughton, North Carolina. And, you know, all the troopers at this point seem to know I'm on my way in, and they're playing some different game, you know, and now I'm fodder for their game. And they put me in the waiting room. They won't let me sleep, you know, so they've kept me awake already at this point. I've been awake for, you know, I want to say probably 36, maybe 48 hours. And I mean, and there were a lot of other strange things that had happened at that point, simply from sleep deprivation and probably, you know, amphetamine-induced psychosis. And so this unwinds. I go through the interview with the state troopers. They have, you know, they somehow or another they get a hold of my father, and I talk to my dad, and he's like, you know, they need to commit you to observe you for a period of time, and they're going to hold you for like 3 days, and if everything's fine, then they'll let you go, and otherwise we'll take it from there, but you need to sign yourself in, you know. And so they've, you know, they're going back and forth. And I remember, one of the things I remember is they have all these arrowheads on the wall in the state trooper office, and all the state troopers are in there, and they're all in their cowboy hats. And to me, it's just, it's clear, you know, all the cowboys have me, I'm the Indian, you know, and they start telling me, you know, that, you know, you take LSD, it'll make you think you're an ant, all these people like in an anthill, and just like all this gibberish, very, very crazy at that point. And I'm just so tired and over it. So they take me to sign myself in. I'm going to sign myself in. And when I get there, the woman at the desk says, is this the one that you've brought for shock treatment? At which time I refuse to sign myself in, because, you know, I mean, I have no idea what's going to happen at that point, but I know I don't want to be electrocuted, and I know this is bad. And at which point, then the police become very angry, because now I'm not following through with what they want me to do. They throw me in the back of the car again. You know, we're having sort of this angry discussion. I won't tell them what they want to know. Eventually, they take me to a psychologist who is, you know, a nice enough fellow, I have to say, who says, you know, I think, you know, things have kind of bent for you, you need to get some sleep. And so they take me, they commit me, and they hit me with some sort, I would imagine phenobarbital, just took me completely out. And by the next morning, when I came to, I was so medicated at that point. I'm on Thorazine and Cogentin, and this was before later being put on Stelazine and Cogentin, which is actually much more strong as far as a sledgehammer type antipsychotic that they don't even use anymore. I mean, this was in the 80s. That at this point, just everything's bad. I mean, it's the bad side of manic, where you're reading into every... I remember there were these stories about Michael Jackson at the point, and everything seems to be metaphorical at that point. It's all a metaphor back to whatever the trip is that's going on. And
I want to ask you just like a little bit about that state of mind, in terms of... How did it compare even at the time? Is it familiar, like, oh, yeah, I've been in dream states, or I've been in hypnagogic states, or I've been in psychoactive states that are kind of like this? Or is there really something kind of different for you, in, either in retrospect or at the time, in terms of that almost mad, you know, so when you just, that's the thing about madness is you describe it that way as like everything becomes a metaphor. In a way, that's sort of what we want. We want this like rich world where everything is sort of a poem and is telling us its story and it's all connected and, you know, but at the same time, it's of course really harrowing. So how are you, you know, how are you mapping it even, you know, I mean, before the point where you're not now, where they hit you with all this, all these drugs, but just that sort of magical world side of it.
Oh, it's a really interesting question because there. Let's move forward a little bit when I'm,
sure.
I'm you know, in the, because I ended up going through four different hospitals during the course of this, and while I'm at the second hospital, there's this point where I have this realization where, and I'll circle back and answer the question more specifically, but for the longest time, to me, there had been this sort of pursuit towards brilliance and understanding of the universe and our situation within it. And also always kind of feeling like there really weren't geniuses out there. It had more to do with how you applied yourself or if you believe that you know, this was accessible to all of us. And that was this pursuit for me. I wanted to, you know, deeply to understand, you know, the reason of, like, why are we here and how does this all hang together? And I remember at one point in the second hospital literally being at a point where, and it's tough for me even at this point to even remember it, because as those doors shut back down, thankfully, it's tough for you to get back to it. But I remember being at a point where I thought I worked all this time for brilliance, and now I truly do understand the mechanics of the whole machine, and all I could do was just pray for ignorance at that point. I just wanted to shut the fire hose off. You know, with regard to the information. What happens is, when you're at that point, the part I do remember is, like, sleep is no longer an option. There's too much material that you have to work through that you're quantifying, right? And you're so tired and you just want to go to sleep. But the truth is that there's so much more for you to get through, you know, to sort of get to whatever this answer is. I don't even know why you're trying to solve the problem, right? Like, what the outcome is. It's not like you're going to get some gold star at the end of it, or, you know, but yet you have to keep trudging forward, and you can try and sleep, but there's just more data. So there's that aspect. And then, as far as, like, the metaphor being different, let's put it this way. Up until just before this point, you know, I had experimented rather heavily with sort of, I guess, the first guard of psychedelics, not really, you know, the era of cyclohexamines or the other designer drugs, but more just, you know, LSD, psilocybin, MDMA, these sorts of, well, I guess, designer drug, but, and I had only had one experience up until then where I had had sort of this dramatic shift where suddenly I had punched through to something that, you know, otherwise it was just sort of fun and you're just kind of laughing and, you know, it's the experience I think a lot of people have. It's not so, you know, oh my gosh, there's something sinister going on here. They haven't told me the whole truth, and now I'm kind of seeing it. But I guess, and then when the big break happened, the one thing that I forgot to mention was actually while I'm in Hampton, it pretty much started. There were these entities that sort of came to visit me that, you know, were kind of these really ruffian deadhead tour types, and they gave me this book. I think you've actually read it at this point. You had it, the anthology. It's called The Lice, and it's just this poetry. And I read this poem, and I think the big break kind of happened when suddenly the whole foundation that had been set up with me, you know, and my sort of my Southern Christian upbringing and my notion of family, and I'm going to have children, and there's this God, and there's this Christ, and you know, I just did never question any of that. I just guess I had never had a faith crisis. And suddenly it just kicked the foundation out from under me and said, essentially, you know, there's this life. I remember the sort of the visual of it was that, you know, life is kind of this tree that's continuing to grow out through generations and generations. But the only way back to reality is to stop that progression, turn back on it, and start working your way back through the karma of these nodes of growth until you get back to the root, then the seed, then the genesis, and you go into the nothingness that sort of is the unity and the oneness of things. And that suddenly it was upon me, on behalf of my dad, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, to get this horrible cosmic joke and to be the strong one that would say, I'm not having kids, I'm turning back on this, and I'm going to start the progression back, because if I don't, then I'll just be another node on this tree, basically, waiting for someone to have the courage to turn back on it. And I guess that really was the genesis of the big break, right? And that was certainly something that, you know, I'd never thought before. And the metaphor coming to you at that point is, it's very different. It's not metaphor like, you know, life is like a wave, or we're the tide coming in, or we're the tide going out. It's much more pointed. It's sinister. At least it felt that way to me. You know, stories.
I remember when you first told me that vision that you had about in terms of children and that going upstream, and what that's kind of what's remarkable about it is you can see that in the way in which that's kind of a whatever a potential a seed for a kind of psychotic situation or a situation of real sort of dread about existence and how it could sort of feed that view. But at the same time, it's kind of a remarkable story or image or even a truthful one in some ways. There's this sense of that we're kind of driven by our society, by our body, by DNA to reproduce, and there's a way in which it's kind of this trap, and you know that Gnostics for centuries have seen it in that light, and so there's something about the way in which these experiences, even as they are clearly embedded in deeply screwed up brain break situations, that there is this kind of insight in them at the same time, and that's part of the peculiarity of them.
Well, and I'll push that back to you and things that I've heard you say through the years, which I thought were remarkable. When you were doing the Burning Man opera, there's a moment, I can't remember exactly the line, but basically what you're saying is that people think that psychedelics and all of this is, oh, it's all fun and games. And that at the end of the day, you know, it ends up being hard work. It ends up being sinister. It ends up being like, you know, painful at times. And, and this was certainly an instance of it. I mean, I also remember being at Burning Man when, what was the play you guys did in 1999 that you were part of at Burning Man?
Oh, we did DJ Christ Superstar, a sort of rave remix of Jesus Christ Superstar.
And it was so funny because I remember at one point there was this screen where you guys were projecting images onto the screen kind of outside of it, and or maybe it was the camp next to you, and it was someone was ranting just these things that were just basically meant to take someone who is potentially having a bad trip at Burning Man over the edge, right? You know, and I remember saying, what kind of friends would bring you to Burning Man and give you acid and then just leave you on the playa by yourself and these sorts of things, right? Just sort of like pushing someone over the edge. And one of the things that I discovered was that after being through it, right? Well, let's talk about this quickly. Like when I finally, when I'm through the first hospital and the second hospital, and I'm finally in the third hospital, right? And they still have me on a ton of meds at this point, which is horrible, right? I mean, I'm not really sure how they treat people for psychosis now, but when I've talked to people, doctors at this point about what happened, during my tenure, they just look at me like I'm a dinosaur. Like, you know, legally, they wouldn't be able to administer the chemical straitjackets anymore. that they did. And so there's a point where I have this conversation with my dad, and I'm just like, hey, look, you know, the reason everything is so crazy for me right now is because, you know, they're giving me all these drugs, and you have to tell them they have to stop giving me these drugs, right? Or I'm going to sign myself out. I'm going to, you know, give them 72 hours notice, and we'll just have to deal with it from there. And so they take me off of the drugs. And so when they take you off of them, you're so sedated that for about the first, I want to say, like, probably almost 3 days, I didn't sleep because I was just suddenly, you know, just on fire, like, from all the sedation coming off of me. And when I finally did go to sleep, and I just had this huge, you know, incredible deep crashing sleep, and you wake up, you're soaking wet, everything's wet from all the perspiration, but it was this feeling of sort of swimming towards the surface, being deep underwater and swimming towards the surface, and finally, like, breaking through the surface of the water and getting that first breath of air, and just realizing I was completely back to myself, just very quickly, you know, and everything seemed normal again. There was the residue of what had happened, and of course that took years to process. You know, you still process it. That's just part of who you are at that point. But all the metaphor, all the speaking to me, all of that was gone, you know.
Well, this is great. I want to take a break right here, but we'll get back and, you know, dive into, you know, all the issues opened up by this. Especially, I want to hear more about, a little more about, like, just the mind fuck, basically, that that being in those institutions creates. And it's like, you know, another trap to try to escape from. But anyway, you are listening to Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis, and we'll be right back on after these messages.
Listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Hi, Progressive Radio fans. I'm Betsy Rosenberg, and I do a program here on the network called The Green Front, as in reporting from the green front lines. That's where I've been for more than a decade, covering a beat that I think is fun, fascinating, fact-filled, and sometimes even kind of funny. Or not, when you consider the implications of our world-class denial here in America. The Green Front is an ostrich-free zone, though, where I select the most interesting and passionate eco-innovators out there and bring them to you live each Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern. So join me as we wake up America with the activists, authors, experts, and ordinary citizens out there making an extraordinary green difference.
This is Barry Farber with the best self-improvement advice you've ever had or ever heard. Learn a foreign language. Sounds impossible? Give me a chance to prove that I'm Barry Farber. I can guide you to mastery of any language in the world quickly, easily, inexpensively, and at home. You will grow culturally, linguistically, intellectually, commercially, professionally, even romantically. Get that smile off your face. It happened to me. Listen to the Barry Farber Language Club for details. Wednesday mornings right here on the Progressive Radio Network. Every Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. beginning March 23rd.
Have you heard of Burt Cohen Show brings you the hidden truths behind the stories that affect us all and gives you the information you need to build freedom, community, and a much better world. This is Burt Cohen. My past shows include The New Media Power of Comcast, Socialism for Wall Street Only, and How to Empower Your Own Community Over Corporate Interests. For archives, go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and listen to The Burt Cohen Show every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. The Burt Cohen Show. There's really nothing like it.
Yeah, Jeff.
Your girlfriend gave another interview.
No, don't play it.
Listen to this.
I have a journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this cornerstone of our democracy is a free press.
Shut it off. I said not to play it.
We are in the worst reality show in history.
Why won't she shut up?
You know she's going to be president, right?
Okay, stop it. That's not funny.
I think we should just go limp. Lay back. Maybe then the Mama Grizzly won't tear off your limbs.
Cheater in the Rude, Thursdays, 8 p.m., Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network, your voice for independent views.
Hi, folks. Welcome back to Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis, and we're talking to Jody Edmondson about his experience on the outer edge of consciousness. Even though it's sick, we've all seen, you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, etc. I recall you describing the kind of Catch 22, really mindfuck is the only way to describe it, that exists for somebody in these institutions, that you sort of lose the thread, and that, like, to get out becomes this whole other issue on top of what happened to you that brought you there in the first place. Could you tell me a little bit more about, like, the flavor of that, the situation of that, the doctors, your own sense of what was real and not real? And it's just such a place that, you know, you don't want anyone to have to wind up, and yet a lot of us wind up there at one point or the other, or know people who do, and it's helpful to know more about it.
Yeah, one of the things that happened with me was I was a psychology student when all of this happened, and at one point I just felt like, oh, this must be part of the degree program. This is sort of the weeding out of the chaff, where basically this happens, they pretty much throw you in, and you have to, you know, first person be able to deal with the ramifications of this, and that's how you'll actually progress forward in the degree program or not. So that was one aspect of it. Another aspect was realizing later on, particularly after they had taken the meds out of the equation, that regardless of what I thought had happened or how strongly I felt about what had happened, there are definitely right and wrong answers in an institution. And if you want to leave, you have to start giving the correct answers, regardless of whether you truly believe them or not. You know, the locks and the gates are basically configured in a way that if you tell the doctor what you're supposed to tell the doctor, then you'll be able to progress. If you don't tell the doctor what you're supposed to tell the doctor, then you'll be held back. And it doesn't really matter what you think in terms of reality. It for me, at least, the biggest thing was, how do I extricate myself from the situation and get back to freedom, you know? And I don't want to paint the doctors all with a broad stroke. I mean, there were good doctors. There were very bad doctors. There were, people who were great, particularly psychologists that I worked with, that there was one in particular because by the third hospital, I had come off of the meds. Everyone was like, you know, we don't really think anything's wrong with you, but there was an option to go to this fourth hospital. It was almost kind of like a grad degree in the program of all of this, where I went to Timberlawn in Texas. I don't know if any of the listeners, I know you're in Texas, so someone out there is probably familiar with Timberlawn. That was the last place that I ended up. And that was really intense, you know, the level of interaction I had. I had a psychiatrist, I had various psych techs I worked with, groups that I was working with, and I had a psychologist that I saw several times a week. And he was profound, because that was the first person I think that ever sort of gave me permission to, you know, to feel the way I felt about something. You know, he would ask me, you know, how does this, you know, did that make you angry? And I guess my, you know, knee-jerk reaction was like, no, I'm okay with it. And he would say, no, really, you know, it's quit pretending that you're a saint and really, you know, is this something that made you angry? And eventually I was able to kind of, with him, get in touch with some of the things that had happened and emotionally how they made me feel. And in the third hospital prior to Timberlawn, there was a guy who was my psychologist who had actually had a psychotic break. And he was phenomenal, because it was the only person during most of this that had any idea what it was that I was telling him. But now it's pretty firmly grounded back in consensus reality. And so on the one hand, was able to say, yeah, you know, what you experienced is valid. And at the end of the day, I mean, you know, experience is what we have with regard to being able to define, you know, what's going on or what's not going on. And, but at the same time, to be able to say, you know, but you are this small percentage of, you know, this experience is just not something that most people have experienced. And so they're having a really tough time connecting, you know, with what you're telling them. But yeah, you, at some point or another, you begin to play the game if you want to leave. Because I looked around at other people who continued to be rebellious, or they, regardless of how, whether they were right or they were wrong, they were insistent on holding their position. And based on doing that, you know, at the end of the day, that created a lot of pain for them, because, you know, ultimately their rights were taken away from them in the hospital, and they weren't going to be able to leave.
So how did you finally make the break?
Oh, you know, fairly far into the experience at the last hospital, it was a B.F. Skinner behavior modification hospital that I was in. And essentially what they said was, you know, you have to basically, you know, ask for different permissions along the way, and you're either granted these permissions or you're not. And so each time I came up to ask for permissions, I would ask for the maximum permissions in terms of things like, you know, different freedom that they allow you in the hospital. And each time I was granted, you know, whatever I asked for. And the first time that they basically said, no, you know, we're not going to grant you, we're not going to grant you permissions this time. And to me, it seemed like I didn't understand, like, why are you not granting me permissions? What have I done wrong? You know, I've played along. And at which point, that's when I went and I saw my doctor and I said, you know, I'm going to give you 72 hours at this point, because in these institutions, I wasn't committed at this point. What had happened was, I was actually, I'd signed myself in. And so based on that, had the ability to essentially sign myself out. And so
I said, you know, I'm going to sign myself out is what I'm going to do. And so I went, I saw my doctor, and my doctor said, you know, you shouldn't do that because that's gonna make it appear like you actually are crazy, you know. And so I had, pretty soon thereafter, I had a review coming up, and that was at the point that the, you know, my primary doctor said, here are the different options that we have at this point, you know. You can stay, which he had trepidation, because I think there are sort of studies that say the longer you leave someone in a situation like this, the more they sort of become shaped by it, and they start to act like the other patients. And so, you know, that being that, they were like, you know, we want, you know, probably for you to take off, you know, but they had to figure out the right, you know, scenario based on that, whether I should, you know, at that point, continue to stay within the hospital system that I was at, or if I should. I mean, one thing they were really pushing hard for is they wanted me to stay in Texas, and they wanted me to finish school in Dallas at SMU, because I was already in a psychology program, and their feeling was that it's so rare for anyone to have been through whatever the experience I had been through was, and then to proceed and to get their degree, because everyone else is just sort of theorizing about what goes on, you know. And
well, I want to jump in on this just because we, you know, we got about 10 minutes left, and I'd love to have some reflections from you as being, you know, someone who, while you didn't become a psychologist, you know, you remain very interested in these issues. You're a keen observer of human beings. You've had a lot of unusual experiences through a whole variety of spiritual and psychoactive approaches, et cetera. At this point, where do you place this experience, either for yourself personally or for what these things mean? I mean, are they aberrations? Are they on a continuum with other experiences? How do you kind of open it up into its sort of deeper meaning?
I still wrestle with that question. I don't know how it fits in, other than it's something, you know, like all the other experiences that you have, that, you know, it shapes who you are. It gives you compassion towards other people. Perhaps you have windows that you were able to look through that other people maybe didn't get to look through. I mean, and I wouldn't trade it. I feel like, you know, it's given life deep meaning in many ways. I very rarely worry that I may be going crazy at this point, you know, after sort of having been through that. You definitely, you know, the difference between I'm stressed out and I'm really losing touch, you know.
Do you think that this kind of stuff, or for you, like, did it happen to you? Do you, just for purely organic reasons, just the throw of the dice genetically or whatever, or do you feel that in some ways, like, you're, as you tell yourself the story of your life of why things happen, you know, we all have those stories, does it sort of fit in a way, or is it almost a sort of anomalous rupture, like I got hit by a car?
No, it's a 10, because what I think was that, I don't know how much genetics have to do with it, you know, perhaps something, but definitely the indoctrination into the flavors of sort of Southern Protestant Christianity that I had been through, and sort of the trajectory that I was on toward that path, and just a lack of questioning all of that, right? And I mean, frankly, if you think about it, there are so many things that, like, so, okay, we label, because it was outside of the realm of church, you know, I guess a lot of these experiences as psychosis, but I can point to many things that individuals would tell you under the guise of religion that you would say that's absolutely madness, you know, what you're telling me. You have no basis to believe that. This is, you know, conjecture. And where are you coming up with this? But for some reason or another, because it's the church has sanctioned it in some way or another, or one religion or another religion has sanctioned this in one way or another, you can say these things. In fact, you can say them in public, on television, you know, outside of the, and people don't think you're crazy. They just are sort of like, well, that's your faith. That's what you believe. You know?
Yeah, that's a really remarkable one, because if you, it's, even if you're a secular person, you know, you just sort of take it for granted, like, oh yeah, whatever. And then if you just sort of like write down the beliefs, wait, this guy died, and then he becomes a cracker, and you eat the cracker. You know, it's
you
like if you're from an alien perspective, it's just so bizarre, and yet we just sort of accept it. And I'm not saying that's a reason for us to like just turn against all religious forms and see them all as like, you know, narratives of psychosis. But it's just a really it just shows you how big a challenge these kinds of breaks make for our shared social reality, because if they were just purely negative, purely destructive, purely horrifying, then that would be one thing. Then you avoid them as much as possible, whatever. But there's clearly a creative aspect to it too. Like when you tell me your stories, I can hear the way in which the way you think about the world, the person that you are, is partly through that. And that people have visions, people hear stories, people get, you know, downloads or whatever. I mean, I'm curious, was there anything that you got, like a message or an image or a contact or whatever, that you still kind of hold in a way, like the way that you hold a powerful dream or a powerful synchronicity? Is there stuff about the experience that you go like, well, that one part, you know, in a way that's something that I kind of hold to in a way, or at least it's part of my kind of psychic life?
Oh, I think the whole experience I hold to in that way, because at the end of the day, I'm reading this book, and it's called The Holographic Universe, and it actually was written around the time that all of this happened to me, and it's someone else is describing many of the same things that happened to me, that when I'm in the hospital, I'm trying to explain to the doctors, and, you know, and basically the psychologists are saying, you know, you really can't tell your doctor that if you ever want to get out of here, and, you know, I'm thinking to myself, wow, okay, so, you know, it's almost like me describing a corner in New York, you know, to someone else who's been on that corner, and they're like, oh yeah, I know that corner, you know, and there's the deli there right across the street, and then the bus station or what have you, you know, and I love that restaurant that's right there, and you have that connection where you're like, yeah, it's totally familiar, we've both been there, right? Well, for me, for the longest time, whatever I had experienced was a very lonely place, because there just weren't people that I could talk to that had experienced. People appreciate it. They're fascinated by it. So then to actually have people write about it and describe it in a very articulate way and say, you know, this is kind of how this space is put together, I was like, ooh, it was kind of like this warm, fuzzy thing, you know, to read that and be like, wow, okay, that's cool. Other people have been there. The other thing that happens is over time you become jaded about the whole thing. You're like, well, okay, yeah, it's there, but you got to move on, because now I'm back in the world of, you know, just consensus reality, and this is what we have to work with. And so you just kind of leave that, you know, for what it was. But I think the biggest thing is knowing that, kind of woven into what it is that most people experience all the time, there are all these optional little shifts that can take everything in profoundly different directions in terms of what you're perceiving and what you're feeling and what's going on and how everything's put together. And the other thing is that breaking into those places is not voluntary and can happen sort of at different given points in time. And so, you know, there's a real respect and sort of, you know, just a like, wow, okay, so let's be careful. Let's not you know, let's not accidentally get into some space that we don't want to be in, that now we're governed by the physics of that dimension rather than go ahead.
Yeah, that's where I've come from just, you know, experiencing things through people, through my own weird path, is that social reality, consensus reality, feels so solid. And if we really, in a lot of ways, if we try to break out of it, we bounce back really quickly. You get smashed
right.
One night, you wake up the next day with a hangover, whatever.
Most
of the normal ways we try to escape or bend, they just bounce back. They're part of it already. But at the same time, from another angle, it's really very, very fragile. Very fragile. It's based on certain ways of reading, certain ways of communicating, of having other people kind of sustain us in a kind of collective agreement. And that it doesn't actually take that much for the brain to start going in another direction, or the mind, or however you want to call it, you know, reading cues in a different way. And then suddenly you make a few turns of the corner and you're in an entirely new and often totally lonely landscape. So I think my experience is people who have gone through these things, and, you know, to some degree, though not to that extent, I've gone through things similarly. I've gone through periods of really strong paranoia. I've had clusters of synchronicities that became kind of uncomfortable, you know, whatever. It's given me a real appreciation for consensus reality. You know, there's a lot of people, the counterculture, the whatever, you see how rotten the world is, and you're like, oh, consensus reality is holding us back, man. And you're like, yeah, it's kind of a problem, but, you know, it's real sweet in other ways, too.
It's real sweet in other ways, you know?
Yeah.
And a lot of it is sort of this unspoken contract that we have with each other, you know, and a lot of it, I think we operate under that contract, and we've never even really read it. We're just part of it, you know, and that's just how we behave. But I certainly think you have individuals, for instance, individuals with Asperger's, you know, who suddenly, like, their position on everything is so dramatically removed from kind of the cluster of reality, right? Like, one of the things that happened in all of this is they did a lot of testing.
Jody, we got a minute left here, so I just want to let you know.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, I guess to that point, you know, you have people who see the world in profoundly different ways, and they're sort of outliers on that cluster of reality. And I think any of us at any point suddenly can find ourselves out on the periphery like that. And things are very different from that perspective.
Well, thank you so much for giving us your story of that difference and giving us that perspective. I really appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you, Eric. It was great to be here. I really appreciate it.
Wonderful. Well, this is Eric Davis from Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your minds open.